ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You can't control what you don't understand. I'm Rae Johnston, and in Opt Out, I'm taking back control of my digital life. Join me as I track down my data, lock down my accounts, and learn how to fight back. Opt Out, the Download This Show guide to getting off the internet. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app. This is The Book Show. Hello, I'm Claire Nichols. And today, I'm taking you to Margaret River in WA, on the lands of the Wurundjeri people, to spend an hour with the queen of commercial fiction, Marion Keyes. Marion is one of the most successful Irish writers ever. Her books, they defy genre. They're funny and relatable. There's great clothes, swoony romance. But they're also about real challenging stuff, about addiction and depression, domestic violence, and even abortion. She has an incredible skill for bringing light and laughs to the darkest of topics. Marion's 16th novel is My Favourite Mistake, and it's another story about one of her beloved Walsh sisters, a family she's been writing about for 30 years. I had the great pleasure of speaking to Marion Keyes at the Margaret River Readers and Writers Festival.
Thanks. Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you so much for that lovely welcome. But I am really, sincerely, genuinely delighted to be here. And can I tell you why? I'd like to be here in Margaret River especially. Right, so my best friend, Posh Kate, her daughter moved to Australia and had a little boy. So in February of 2020, Posh Kate popped over to Perth from Dublin to see her daughter and to spend, 3 months maybe with the baba and everything, you know? And the next thing you know, this old thing called COVID comes along and the entire world goes into lockdown. And like, Kate is trapped in Western Australia and I am trapped in Ireland. And everything went bananas. And then Kate's daughter, Clara, has another baby. And then I thought, she's never coming back, you know? But then she'd be, and I would say, oh, so tell me about your life there. She'd be like, oh, you know, we had this most beautiful weekend down in the Margaret River. And I'm like, what's this Margaret River business, you know? Very jealous, because we used to have lovely weekends down in other places in Ireland, you know? It couldn't possibly be as nice as the ones in Ireland. But then she was sending me photographs, and then I was looking at things. And then I was saying, what do you do? And she goes, there's all these chocolate shops. There's chocolate shops. Chocolate shops. Oh, and there's one in the town, is called Temper Temper. Temper Temper. And then, I hear about, the soaps and the bread and the beautiful cake and everything. And I thought, she's really never coming back, you know? We can't compete with this. But then, okay, right, so then last October, my publicists, they are the scary people who come to your house or make you sometimes have to go into the office, and they kind of sit you down and they go, okay, we have plans for you for the next 2 or 3 years, and you're thinking, quaking, where are they going to send me, whatever. And they say, okay, they'd really love you to go to Australia. And I said, this is great. You know, I love Australia. This is fine. And then they said, now, there's a place that they have expressed interest in you. It's called, checks notes, Margaret River. And I was like, oh my God, yes, yes, yes. Put it down for now. Put it down right now. I'm coming. And it was just like, it was just one of those serendipitous, gorgeous things that the universe just gives you. Because they didn't know that I had been Googling, the inhabitants of Margaret River and finding out who owned what, chocolate shop, and do they also own the soap shop? I could do a PhD on the Margaret River at this stage. And so I would be happy to be here anyway, because I always find the welcome from Australians so warm and enthusiastic. But the fact that it is this special place that is so special to my beloved Posh Kate and her family, you know, that just makes it extra gorgeous. So, anyway, that was a very long hello. That's my way, I'm afraid.
I think it's clear that Margaret River is very happy to have you. But I want to start with some language lessons, Marion Keys. Can we start with a feathery stroker, please? What is a feathery stroker?
Yes, now, OK, I will tell you now, those with a more kind of delicate sensibility may need some smelling salts at some stage during this. But we will proceed on the basis that most of you are robust. Right. A long time ago, about 20 years ago, my sister Katrina and her friend Anne-Marie were living in New York. Now, times were different then. Do you know, we were all a lot more hardy, I think we've become kinder and softer in ourselves. Anyway, one of them, and I can't remember which, went out for the evening and met a gentleman, and liked the look of said gentleman, said gentleman liked the look of her, and they decided that they would continue to the home of said gentleman, where they engaged in sexual congress. And so, I can't remember if it was my sister or her friend, but anyway, the one who it was came home the next day. And like, my sister and her friend lived in a very, very small apartment, so there were two lovely things about having had sexual congress with the man. Was one, you got to sleep in a comfortable bed, which, I mean, we all love that, you know. And then the other thing was like, well, how was it? Like, and she was, oh, it was, oh. He just stroked me, oh, all night long, just in this feathery way. It was just, oh, it was so boring. It was like, it was just, you know, and I'm just waiting for him to pile drive me into a headboard. And, no. And it's just feathery. And I'm trying to get asleep, and he's irritating me, trying to get him off me and all, you know? And so, you know, I got it, she got it, we all got it. We knew what she was talking about, and nobody wanted it. But, okay, but very quickly it became not just a man who strokes you in a feathery, strokery way all night when you would be preferred to be up to livelier things. It became to describe a man who rings his mother more than once a decade. Or, you know, a man who would quite openly, in public, eat a low-fat strawberry yogurt. A man who might notice that you'd had your hair cut. They might go, there's something different about you. You know, like, it became this sort of, it was brutal, it was cruel. And, like, the minute a man became, like, tarred as a feathery stroker, that was it. Like, he could never be redeemed. He was gone forever. Like, because in My Favourite Mistake, it's a sequel. And so Feathery Stroker first appeared in a book a long time ago. But you see, times have changed, and I think we're all a lot more fragile, I think, now. And many people have openly stated that they would quite like a feathery stroker. I am going on record here as saying that I am actually married to a feathery stroker. And, you know, it's nice. It's nice if you don't feel like getting yourself a glass of water and you're just lying in the bed and you can just kind of, you know, thumb somebody with your toe, like kind of shove your toe at the other person's foot and say, get us a glass of water, will you? And they'll get it, because they're feathery strokers. Do you see, like, they're obliging and they're kind. So this is where, like, language mutates, and that's the beauty of language, that something that was once a bad, terrible thing has now become almost a kind of a winky little wouldn't mind myself one of them.
Pleased to hear it, because everything you were saying about feathery strokers sounded lovely to me.
Yes! Yeah, yeah. But 20 years ago when, you know, when people were young and everything was more brutal, you know, and in magazines they do the circle of shame at people's cellulite and stuff like that. We wouldn't put up with that anymore either. Yeah. You know, yeah, no, times have become softer, I think.
Okay, so we know what a feathery stroker is. What about a dose? What makes someone a dose?
Okay, a dose, right. I think this is a very Irish word. Okay, a dose is a terrible thing. To be a dose is the worst. Okay, a dose can mean, well, an intensely boring person. I think that more than anything, Christ, he's a dose. You know, like, say there was three of you together, you know, one person knew two of you, but the one who knew the two of you had gone off for 5 minutes, I don't know, to get biscuits or something, and then you're left with the dose who would say things like, so what journey did you take coming here today? Was it, did you come on the M50 or did you come over the Wicklow Mountains? That's a dose. Yeah, a dose would be the kind of person that you would really, really, you would pay an awful lot of money never, ever, ever to be alone with them ever again. Ever again. I think you'll instinctively know when to use it. Do you feel?
We can all go home and try to use dose in a sentence tonight, everyone.
Yeah.
I love hearing, I mean, we just love hearing you talk, Marion, because this is the voice that we see in your writing as well. It's so distinctly Marion Keyes. It's so playful. It's so musical. I mean, is this just what conversation was like in your family growing up?
I mean, I know it's kind of almost a cliche to say it, but yeah, like my mother is 93 and she lives for the chat. Mm. Like she lives for the chat, she lives for the crack. Like she enjoys human beings, she likes their foibles, she likes exaggerating. She came from a rural part of Ireland where they have, you know, a very kind of specific dialogue. You know, and I didn't grow up around books, but I grew up around conversation. Like, conversation mattered, and being funny mattered. Like, when my mother got married, she had to give up work because that was the law in Ireland at the time. I know it's a disgrace. And she really loved the kind of the social life at work, you know, the whole thing. Suddenly, she's living, you know, in a small, newly built estate in County Cork, with nobody to play with, and kind of she really missed all of that. And I think she really, so anytime she gets any opportunity at conversation, she's on it, you know, and it's got to be funny, you know.
So you've grown up in this house with like conversation almost as sport, you know,
yes.
With this huge love of language and storytelling.
Yes.
But I know that you didn't think, you know, as a younger person, I will be a writer, I will be a professional storyteller. That wasn't until you're 30, right?
Yeah.
You started writing. So what changed for you? What was the driver that meant I should write stories, I should tell stories for a living?
I mean, it's really hard to write. Look, you see, the way we grew up, like, we were sort of, I don't know, lower middle class. Like, you kind of don't know what you are. But it meant that, like, both my parents had come from, you know, like, my mother came from a three-roomed farmhouse, you know, and my dad came from, he was a scholarship boy. Like, they didn't come from money, and they both had that fear of, you know, they had kind of infiltrated the middle class, but they didn't feel it wouldn't take much to get them relegated, you know. And the idea of being a writer was beyond, I couldn't even imagine it, you know. I always thought writers were very posh, and that they came from a, you know, a long line of poshos, and that they all, and they owned the publishing houses, and, you know, they were just a different breed completely. And like, I read an awful lot, but the things I read, none of them were about people like me. And my dad was very, I don't know if you have a phrase here in Australia, it's probably gone out of fashion in Ireland now, but what you wanted from a job was it for it to be permanent and pensionable. Mm. So basically you worked if you could for the civil service. Like, I mean, that was kind of your ticket to safety and relative prosperity. So when I left school, the way it was, like, I got enough points in my final exams to study law. So I studied law because I qualified to study law, but I couldn't care less. I didn't even know what the law was, you know. And all, you know, and so many of the other kids in my class, like, they came from, like, dads who were barristers or dads who were high court judges, and, you know, and they already understood why they were there. And, like, so I did my 3 years, like, you know, drinking my head off, learning nothing. I mean, and also the kind of person I was, I didn't ever see any kind of a future for me. Like I was, you know, I know people joke about it, like with children suffering from depression, but I did. Like I felt absolutely nihilistic from really early on. And so books were reading was my, I suppose, my first drug. Then sugar was my second, and then, you know, and then I met alcohol, and that was like, you know, the absolute, you know, the love affair. So I got my degree, then I promptly went to London and became a waiter, and meanwhile, back in Dublin, my parents were like dancing jigs of delight. They weren't. And then I drank my way through my 20s, and everyone was telling me that I was in trouble with alcohol, and I thought, I'm just incredibly sad, and my life is difficult, and when my life is easy, I won't have to drink so much. And my life is just like this island that just kept folding in and in and in on itself. And it was only, it was 4 months before I finally stopped drinking that I wrote something. It just came out of the blue. And I do think the timing was interesting or, you know, important because, you know, I wanted to die. That's kind of really all I wanted. And I was off work, should have been at work, read a story in a magazine that had won an award. And it was funny and it was quirky and it wasn't a, you know, it wasn't pompous or anything like that. It was fun. And a voice in me said, you could do something like that. So I wrote, I did, I wrote a short story there and then. And like, it wasn't enough to stop me drinking, but it made me, I was proud of it. It was the first thing I'd ever done, more than a law degree, more than anything. I created that and I was proud of it. And so 4 months later, like crashed and burned, ended up in rehab. And when I came out and everything about me was different because I knew I wasn't going to drink anymore. I knew I didn't want to. And I knew that I felt differently about life. And I remembered those few things that I had written beforehand and I thought, I'd like to actually explore that. So it was a kind of a very weird way of finding out what I wanted to do. And I just feel so lucky that that came for me at a time where I was, I don't know, so reduced to almost nothingness that I responded. And then once I started, I loved it. You know, once I started properly writing, and I just wanted to write about women like me. And it was such fun.
Is it still fun?
It is still such fun. Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Thank you.
Marion, we've loved your writing for 30 years, but you have picked up a new job of late. You've become a kind of professional agony aunt.
Yes.
So you're hosting a podcast, a show on the BBC called Now You're Asking. People write in with their problems, their relationship dramas, and you provide advice for them. Like, what does that feel like?
Oh, okay. You see, right, I do it with one of my beloved friends, Tara Flynn, and she is very wise. She's very funny. And she's far more compassionate than I am. And the thing is, like, God, I'm going to break your heart, like some of the things that are sent in. But then some things are really, really, really funny as well. An awful lot of them seem to be about women in kind of 50s, early 60s, who are, you know, rejoining the dating game. And I just love that for them. Like, I want nobody to feel upset. You know, like we want it to be a very safe space where like people can come and tell us their things. But at the same time, I do want people to be entertained. So like it's a narrow line we walk. It is a responsibility though.
Yes.
You know, like there's an awful lot of, oh my God, like the sorrows some people have. I mean, it is shocking. And, you know, without being trite, you know, we do try to offer ways of getting through it moment by moment. You know, I think in many cases it's impossible to kind of offer, well, there's a lovely solution all tied up in a bow, but to say, could we try looking at it a different way? And I mean, an awful lot of it is about, you know, next door squirrels keep eating my flower bulbs. And I'm like, how in the name of God am I meant to know about this? Like, I know nothing about squirrels or bulbs, you know, or I mean, people send the maddest things, like, you know, what is the correct number of minutes to leave a tea bag in a cup? A, I don't drink tea. And B, figure it out yourself. You're an adult.
But what I do like about listening to you on that show is that you do have great answers for so many questions, because you've lived a life, Marion. You know,
that's it,
you
yes.
know, you've talked about your alcoholism, yeah. and you're so generous there. And over your career, you've talked about bouts of depression, you've talked about marriage, Botox, you've talked about yeah. everything. When you're given a role like that, does it actually make you stop for a moment and go, wow, I know some stuff yeah. at this point in my life?
It does. It does. You know, because I'm 61 and a half. And, yeah, and I have learned many, many, many things in my life. You're right. I have learned how to live 31 years free of alcohol, you know. I have learned... Oh, no. I mean, thank you. Well, thank you. But, like, people have been very, very kind to me. Yeah. You know, I lived with depression since the age of 14, and I've moved in and out of it. Like, I went stone bananas in 2010 and eventually came out of it, and that was horrible. Yeah, I wanted to have, you know, six babies, and I didn't even get one, you know. And, like, you move to... Like, that was very, very sad, you know. And then other things, like... I mean, I know everybody suffers bereavement, but, like, yeah, my dad died. That was very, very sad. And, you know, it's the maddest thing. But you always think it's never really going to happen to you, you know, until it does. I learned to drive. Yeah, but, you know...
Wow.
But you know what I mean? Like, there was a time when I thought I wouldn't. I took time out and went back to school last year. Like, you learn things. Yeah, two major friendships and I broke up. That was really shocking. You never think it's going to happen to you, because, you know, female friendships are meant to be bonded forever, and there isn't really any room to talk about it, you know, when it does. I get Botox mm-hmm. and fillers and I feel, you know, perfectly adequate feminist guilt about it, you know, but you're what can you do? So yes, I have plenty of the wisdoms.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm always sick. Always, that's another thing. I have had practically every illness ever. I come from a household of hypochondriacs. Like, my mother leads the way. My mother, a pill for every ill. You know, so I could actually prescribe people. Sometimes I love my local pharmacist, Ronan is his name. And sometimes when my prescription isn't ready, I sit on the chair. There's only one chair, so I make sure I get it. And so I'm sitting on the chair and I'm listening, and people are coming in and they're whispering away there to Ronan. And I say, no, sounds like an allergy to me. Lived many lives.
So you can, yeah. you can be a novelist, an agony aunt, and a chemist. I think this is...
Yes, yep. amongst other things. Yeah. Yes, yes.
You're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National, where I'm speaking to Marion Keyes at the Margaret River Readers and Writers Festival. Marion's 16th novel is My Favourite Mistake, and it's about Anna Walsh, one of the famous Walsh sisters that Marion has been writing about for 30 years. Marion, there are five Walsh sisters. Everyone has their favourite. Each has at least one book. Why do you keep coming back to this family?
God, I don't know. It's so weird. Right, when I wrote my first book 30 years ago, I hadn't a clue what I was doing. I had written to a publisher and I said, I've started writing a novel, and I hadn't. but I had sent some of the short stories I'd written just before I stopped drinking. And they read them and they said, they're lovely, a bit odd. Were you all right when you were writing them? They said, but send us this part of the novel that you've written. And I thought, perfect this, you know? And I thought I could just walk away from it and just pretend it had never happened. But I was in the new version of me, the new skippy, happy, you know, sober Marion business who, like, is embracing life. So I thought, okay, I will write a book about a woman a bit like me, because this was in 1994, where all popular fiction was very aspirational. It was about, you know, very, very fabulous, glamorous women called Letitia, who Oh, you know, we're always doing boardroom takeovers and then having sex on the boardroom table and the whole thing. And like, and I was like, you know, living with my two flatmates, and we were like spending our rent money on shoes, you know, and just, it, you know, life was not easy. And we did not have that whole post-feminist promise of like, anything you want, you, we can have. It was like, no, we're getting nothing. So I thought I would write about somebody like me. Now, I was living in London, and I come from a family of five siblings, two brothers, two sisters, and me. And they say that everybody's first novel is autobiographical. And so, astoundingly, I gave the family five children, like the family I came from. But I made them all women. I don't know why. Obviously, I didn't find my brothers interesting enough. And, like that, I kind of, you know, had a template in my head of what a family looks like. And the mother in the book, Mammy Walsh, is this absolute, you know, she's a matriarch, she's a very powerful figure. And the whole dynamics, like the people in the book are not inspired by my siblings, but the whole dynamic of that family is very similar to the family I come from. You know, we're opinionated, we're noisy, we talk over each other, we take offense very easily, you know, we get over it just as quickly. You know, we make arrangements that quickly become extremely complicated, then they then they collapse under the weight of their complicatedness. You see, and I absolutely love it. I love when I'm in, and it's great now that we're a bit older and, you know, there are more of us because there's like nieces and nephews and stuff. And there's something for me when I'm there with them. If I'm in a room and say I'm talking to my brother-in-law and we're having a lovely chat, and then he starts talking about something I find boring, like the A50 cross where it crosses over the, you know, and I just pick up my plate and I leave the room. And I don't have to say anything. I don't have to explain myself to somebody at all, you know, and then I will go upstairs and I will find, you know, it's not so bad now since we got the Wi-Fi ourselves in the house, but I'll find somebody lying on the landing floor trying to get next door's Wi-Fi, you know, so I sit and I'll have a chat with them for a while. And there's just this feeling of like, they are inoffendable. Is that the word? It doesn't matter how rude you are. You can just do what you like. And then, you know, when children belong to you, like children or grandchildren or whatever, and they say cute things and you just think, oh my God, that's the funniest thing. And I wish people could hear. You see, and when I feel all that, I think, I wish I could give this feeling to my readers. So that's kind of why I keep coming back to the Walshes. The thing is, I realized several books ago that, like, I fetishize family. Like, I really, really, really love the feeling I personally get when I'm in that. I feel incredibly safe there and free. And then, you see, I had planned never to write a sequel because I felt, for a long time, this is just me, I just think, right, I put my characters through a lot in each book, and by the time they get to the end, you know, God love them. They've suffered enough. Let them fly free and be happy. Mm. You know, let them out there. Let them, you know. And then, I mean, people used to always ask about Rachel and Luke. Well, Luke mostly didn't care much about Rachel.
One of the most handsome men in literature.
Yes. And just an idea came from nowhere about a storyline that I thought could work, because it was a long time since I had written their story. I said, I could do this. So after I wrote Again, Rachel, it was such a pleasure being back in that world, you know, because it was familiar to the real one. And then I was all set to write another different, you know, a kind of far more ambitious opus about people who'd been friends for 40 years and a couple of them had become rich by becoming terrible people. And this was around the time that Russia had invaded Ukraine. We'd just come out of lockdown. And it takes me 2 years to write a book, and I thought, I cannot spend 2 years in the company of awful people. And I asked myself, well, what do I want to write? And then I asked myself, well, what do I want to read? Mm. And at the moment I was I was reading an awful lot of Enemies to Lovers. I still am. And I thought, what about a kind of an Enemies to Lovers for the less youngs? Mm. And I could go back I could go back into Anna and pick up with Anna, see how she's doing. So it gave me such pleasure being in the safe place with Anna and the whole community. And now I'm writing a new book, and then I was all sort of, I'll do Claire. No, and my publisher, who's very, very good normally, she's normally, hello trees, hello flowers, you must do what you would must do, you are an artist. So I said, I was thinking about Claire, and she goes, "Nyet, forget it."
So why?
That was enough watches for a while, she felt.
Okay. So, but Anna is the star of this new one, My Favourite Mistake. She's a lot of people's favourite Walsh sister.
Yes.
Like, what makes Anna so special?
Oh, you see, I mean, I love them all, but I think Anna is, she's very kind. She's far more independent than people realise, I think. She's the most reasonable of them all. Like, Claire, see, I love Claire too, but Claire is a nightmare. Mm-hmm. You know, like, all Claire wants to do is spend money and do whatever the zeitgeist are doing sexually. And then Helen has her own. You see, I love Helen too. But Helen has her burdens, you know. Then Margaret, I think, is a little bit too dull for most people, you know. And then, I mean, it's the truth. Yeah. And then Rachel, you see, Rachel's already had her go, and Rachel has Luke, and it's kind of like, yeah, well, hiya, Rachel, yeah. You see, like this, yeah, you know, bit of jealousy there. Yeah. But, like, Anna is just sound, and I like that independence in her. Mm. You know, like, in the first book, anybody out there, like, she said, like, I used to dream of a white wedding. And then she heard the next sentence was, yeah, I used to wake up screaming. And it's kind of not what you expect. Mm. You know, she spent her life kind of trying to escape from them all. She's the least enmeshed of them all. You know, and she did manage to make it to another continent.
Yeah, she's been living in New York, and at the start of this book, though, she's returning home. You spoke earlier about, you know, revisiting the sisters and thinking maybe I've already put them through the ringer too much.
Yeah.
And Anna, in the first book, goes through... Yeah. You know, kind of unimaginable grief.
Yes.
I get the sense in My Favourite Mistake that you wanted to go a little easier on Anna this time. Like,
yes.
Was that a deliberate choice?
Yes, it was. It absolutely was. I mean, I think the worst thing that could ever happen to anyone has already happened to Anna. And I feel, in a way, what this is giving a person the opportunity to do some midlife spring cleaning. You know, the way, like, you know, we're all different ages here, but we all arrive at a certain point in our life when we kind of go, I cannot believe I did that 10 years ago, 12 years ago. You know, speaking for myself, there are so many things I look back and I think, oh my God, if I had my time again, you know, I would not behave like that. Now that I know better, I must do better, but still I so wish I hadn't done that. And in a way, I mean, Anna is very much faced with this. And, I mean, we can never undo those things. But sometimes we get an opportunity to explain the complexity of feelings and motivations, things that we mightn't even have understood ourselves at the time. And I wanted that for her. You know, and like the character of Joey, you know, he did not live a worthy life as a younger man. And it is, in a way, about people getting a chance to kind of absolution of some sort. Mm. That's what I wanted for her. And I wanted even stuff like, I mean, my sister lives in New York. She's a nurse. Like, she worked really, really hard through the pandemic. You know, that sometimes it's nice to see a person walk away from a very stressful job, you know, which Anna had, a job from the outside which looks like the dreamiest of jobs because you get to fly in planes, you know?
So she's a PR executive for makeup brands. Yeah.
Yeah, and so she gets free makeup and she gets free skincare. So when she tells her sisters that she's given up her job, they want to get an injunction to stop her because it means not only will she not be getting the free skincare and makeup, but neither will they. And it's just so funny how selfish we as human beings can be. Like, nobody could see past that for her. Like, when she came to Ireland to tell them this, then none of them would drive her back to the airport. They were all so annoyed. But that's how people are in real life. You don't say, I'm walking away from my really stressful job, and people don't go, oh, darling, I'm so happy for you. I was so worried for you. You know, that was too hard. They go, what? No. What does this mean for me? Mm. You know, because that's human nature too.
Yeah, she feels that guilt within herself. I shouldn't be giving this up because we're told we should be ambitious, right? We should always be
that's
striving
the ambition.
For more.
That's it. And I do think in an awful lot of people's lives, we hit a point where we think, I am too tired to be ambitious anymore. Mm. Or I'm too tired to keep working this hard. And it's a shocker because, you know, this is the world we live in. Strive, 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 strive. Work harder. Be 5% better. You know, oh God, I met this young, beautiful young woman who was doing my nails in January, and she goes, what are your goals for this year? Like, mother of Jesus, you know? Yeah, to get to the end alive, you know? You know, I'm going to read 5 novels a week, you know, I'm going to run X, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to cut all such and suches from my diet. Like, everything is so brutally goals-driven.
So, for Anna, at the start of this book, you know, she's left her relationship with her feathery stroker, Angelo.
Right, feathery stroker.
Yeah. She's given up the high-powered job in New York. She's come back to Ireland.
Yes.
She's 48.
Yes.
And this is kind of a rude shock, right, to kind of get to this point and go, I'm 48 and I have nothing and I'm starting again.
Like, yeah.
That's terrifying, right?
Yeah, because she doesn't have children, she doesn't have a relationship, she doesn't have a home, she doesn't have a job. You know, all the things that we kind of define ourselves by, she doesn't have them. You know, she has a family, but she's terrified of them. And and she's living on the, you know, and she doesn't have a best friend, which is a whole other story. And so she's living in, God, it's beautiful, in a place called Connemara in County Galway, where she's doing PR for a retreat, there's a big difference, for rich people. So there's no swimming pool, because they're made to go out and to swim in the freezing Atlantic and just be at one with hypothermia, you know? And you know that lark that they're into, you know? And the intermittent fasting, that just means that they're not getting fed, you know? That sort of thing, and they think it's lovely and they're paying like thousands for it. Anyway, the locals aren't pleased, so Anna has been brought in to kind of calm the troubled, very cold waters.
And she goes, so she's gone to this Connemara, but she's spending her time in this town.
Maugham Tully. Yes.
Maugham Tully, and this is definitely one of these small towns where everybody knows everybody's business. My favourite detail about this place is that there's one woman who secretly owns all the jumper shops.
Yes.
On the street.
Yeah.
Have you been to places like this?
Yes, absolutely. You know, there's about 5 jumper shops, but they all have entirely different personalities, you know? So there's the big, hearty fisherman's ones, and then there's the delicate little cashmere ones, you know, the Angora ones, you know? And then there's the really kind of the grim ones that your granny might wear, that, you know, you're like, it's given off electric shocks because it's, you know, it's, you know, synthetic stuff. Yeah.
But it's very shrewd business, right, to just own them all.
Very shrewd. The monopoly
of the jumper monopoly in town. But we want to get to the romance, Marion. So
okay.
We've talked about, you've mentioned Joey. So Joey was someone that Anna has known for a long time, and they've kind of been circling each other for years. Narky Joey. Who is Narky Joey?
Okay, Narky Joey is one of the real men. Any of you who have read Rachel's Holiday will know who the real man is. Narky Joey is Luke Costello's best friend. Now, people didn't know, well, because I didn't know, that Narky Joey and Helen and Anna have been kind of, they've had a thing for each other for 20 years. But, you know, it's never worked out. Like, any time one of them was available, the other got married, this kind of a thing, you know? It's messy. Like, Narky Joey, who was always narky, you know, he had a child with the woman who was Anna's best friend at the time. And then she wasn't her best friend anymore. So it's messy, the way life is messy. And now neither of them are married, and they are both working in different capacities on this project for the 1% who want to go swimming in the Atlantic. And the last time they met each other, Anna was very cruel to him. And it's, again, that thing of, like, you meet somebody from a few years back, and how do you deal with it? And especially when you're having to work with them, and when there's still that kind of frisson there between them. And they have the wrong idea of each other now, because it's 8 years since they've seen each other. And they've both tried their best to be better people, I suppose. Mm. And I mean, I loved writing all of that, you know, I really, really, really did. I mean, I loved the idea of like a love affair for people in their late 40s and early 50s, because we get nothing. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's all the feckin' 23-year-olds and the 31-year-olds, you know?
What I like about a romance between people in their late 40s, early 50s is that Anna and Joey have got a lot of baggage. They have, you know,
yes,
so much baggage. Yeah. There's so much that they have to get through to be together. And I think there's something really admirable, you know, about a relationship that is going to try and get past the kilograms of baggage that are there.
Thank you. Yes, because when you're young, you don't have any of that. Like, you know, and I am a believer. I am a sap, right? I'm the greatest sap. I believe in love. You know, I want everyone to be allowed to fall in love until the day they die. I think the ability and the need to fall in love, you don't age out of it. Mm. This is my knowledge anyway. Like, and I am not young. I mean, I'm not talking about myself because I'm a happily married lady, but you know, for the people around me, like, yeah, so I wanted that for them. And like the fact that you are never going to come like you're just out of the box. Mm. You're not. There's stuff you're going to have to get past. There's stuff that you're going to have to agree to ignore. There's stuff that you can try and fix. And there's stuff that it might just go away by itself, but it is definitely still worth something to fight for, if that's what both people want. That's my manifesto.
I want to go from romance to sex.
Oh, yeah.
Writing sex 30 years later, does it get easier to do?
No. No, it doesn't. Well, different, I suppose. I mean, I think it's harder for people, you know, in their 50s, they feel a bit kind of like, oh, the cut of me. But then I've even noticed, but like, you know, writing sex for younger people, like in their 20s, we're all very, very judgmental of ourselves. Mm. You know, I think whatever age you are, you might as well think I'm a goddess, because you are. You know, you're alive, there's them lungs breathing away, the heart, you know? Like, I think it's not that much harder.
These days are narrating your own audiobooks. Like, what is it like to be in a booth reading a sex scene that you have written?
Oh my God, it is the most horrific thing. Right, on the mornings that I'm going in, I'm thinking, oh, please God, just like an icicle from the sky just lands on me. It's the most dreadful, dreadful thing. And I always, when I sit down, say, I'm never doing this. I'm never, ever, ever, ever writing a sex scene again. Except there's just, it's me and a producer, and we're in this dark little box, and we're like this with each other, you know? And like, we're so up next to each other. And he is, I really love him. Do you know the way when you just meet somebody, you think, you're gas, you're kind, I love you. He makes it so easy. You know, we've a right out laugh. He makes it funny. It would be very hard if I didn't know the person. It's awful. I beg you, you know, it's really, really hard, but it's less hard with Roy.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Roy. Marion, you've talked a little bit about female friendships. You've talked about the loss of a female friendship in your own life. And it's a part of this book, My Favourite Mistake, that I found incredibly moving was the fact that Anna is mourning the loss of a long-time friendship. You said it's something that doesn't have a space for us to talk about. How important was it for you to tell this kind of story in this book?
it is a funny thing because there's too much mythology around female friendship. It's like you meet your best friend, you know, on your first day at school, and you are best friends forever. You have no cross words until the day you die. And I don't know, it's just another one of those kind of sexist things that nice girls don't have fights. Because female friendships are subject to the same laws as any other relationships. And, you know, there's jealousy, there's competitiveness, there's, you know, there's, and people simply change. You know, it doesn't have to be anything malign. People just drift away from each other, like your interests shift. But when a friendship ends in a kind of an explosive row kind of a way, there isn't anywhere to talk about it. People think you're a weirdo. You know, like, say if you and a romantic partner split up, people would be bringing you ice cream and cupcakes and tissues and, like, George Michael songs and bringing you, like, Bridget Jones films. And, you know, people would be lovely to you and saying plenty more fish in the sea and all of that business. But if you say, me and my girlfriend, we had a terrible row and now we're not friends anymore, and, like, people going, what was that all? What do you mean? What's wrong with you? What did you say? What did you do? And so there's no room to grieve. And there's no room to kind of, like, you can't go for couples counselling if you're two friends. Whereas you could go with a romantic partner. And you don't really see it written about. And it's incredibly painful. Like, the two times it happens to me, like, I still dream about the two women. You know, these happened a long time ago. Like, these were profoundly important relationships. And they're just... Anyway, I hope we can talk a bit more about it now.
Yeah, well, it was a part of the book that really moved me a lot because it's something that I've experienced as well, and I'm sure lots of people in the room have. And it is this incredible grief that you feel that feels like you can't... People don't take it too seriously, perhaps. But one thing I loved, because this happened to me as well, was that the character is dreaming about her friend because it's the only place they can kind of reach out and talk to her.
Yes.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you.
I want to talk to you, Marion, about the TV adaptation of The Walsh Sisters. What can you tell us?
Oh, my God. Okay. It is so, 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 so exciting. It's so exciting. Right.
It is... She's pulling up her sleeves. This is serious.
It is 26 years since anything was made of any of my books. And... I long stopped caring or even being interested because I just thought it's never going to happen to me. And then in 2018, another production company started again. And I recommended an Irish screenwriter called Stephanie Preisner because she'd made a show called Can't Cope, Won't Cope. I don't know if you can get it here. I thought she wrote very well about addiction and stuff. So what she has done is she has taken the first five Walsh books and kind of put them all together. So instead of it being like that, she's made them all part of one long cake and then cut it into six episodes. And it's all set in the now, and they're all young, like they're in their late 20s or early 30s. And I have seen it being filmed, and I've seen in the last couple of days some of the rushes. That's lingo. That's what we say. And I cannot tell you. Now, I mean, the young women who played the five sisters, they are just stunning. Did you get Derry Girls here?
We did.
Okay, Louisa Harland, who played Orla in Derry Girls, is playing Anna. But I don't know if you'd know any of the other ones, but they are amazing. And the first time I saw them, like, they were all talking to each other, talking all over each other in this, like, ball of conversation, like, exactly the way I would with my siblings. And, like, the chemistry was so important. Now, do you know Aidan Quinn, who, yes, American actor, yes, who is also Irish. Like, he lived in Ireland for a lot when he was a young'un. He is Daddy Walsh. I swear to God, he is so fabulous. He is so cute. He looks, you'll see. I mean, he is just perfect. He's an anorax and a reading glasses and a slip-on shoes. He's just fantastic. And then, I don't know, did any of you get the quiet girl here around Colleen Kuhn? Yes? Okay, Carrie Crowley, who played the mother in that, plays Mammy Walsh, and she is magnificent. She is magnificent. Now, there was one character that I received an awful lot of letters about, okay?
And that's this Luke Costello?
Yes.
Be still my beating heart.
Yes, 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 yes. And I was consulted on various... I'm sorry, I know there's a child here. I would urge you to please block their ears for the next... next little bit, please. So, they were asking me advice and they were sending me pictures of young men, and I said, one thing you need to know about the casting of Luke Costello. And they were all like at the table, and I said, don't f*** it up. And they were terrified. It's not just me you'll be answering to. There's millions of women out there. Millions of them.
Did they get it right?
Oh, God, yeah. Now, the thing is, the funny thing is, like, Stephanie Preissner, who is the showrunner and did the script, she said everybody has a different picture in their head of what Luke looks like. This game is news to me. Never mind. But the one they have... I tell you, right, who... There is no shame in this, I'm just going to ask you. Who among us here remembers Boyzone? Come on.
Yep.
Yes, yeah, you see, some brave people, okay. Do we remember Keith? Keith Duffy? Yes? He is the son of Keith Duffy.
Oh.
His name is Jay Duffy. He's 29, just gone 29. Has a lovely girlfriend, never mind. And he's just, he's lovely. Like, he's about 12 foot tall and has really broad shoulders and everything. And he's kind of twinkly and sparkly and flirty and all the good ease, you know. And so, but then there's all really moving bits as well. Like, it's really, honest to God, it's gorgeous. Like, I am so excited. Now, I don't know how much I'm allowed to say, but there is some business with an Australian company called Stan.
Yes.
Yeah. Talks are ongoing, I believe.
We'll start writing letters.
Yeah. It's the most exciting, beautiful, thrilling, touching, moving, sweet. Like, I'm not just saying it. Like, it's been so beautiful from start to finish. Like, it's gorgeous.
We can't wait to see it. Everyone, can you please give the hugest round of applause to Marion King?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
That was Marion Keyes with me, Claire Nichols, at the Margaret River Readers and Writers Festival. Thank you so much to the festival for having us both. That conversation was recorded in May, and keep listening to The Book Show over summer as I bring you other highlights from the year. You can follow The Book Show on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to producer Sarah Lestrange and to technical producer David LeMay, as well as the tech team at Margaret River. I'm Claire Nichols, and until next time, take care.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.